Hi, I'm Rachel Kahn. As an RN person, I know you go where angels fear to tread. But if you're up for a spiritual adventure, you can find my program, The Spirit of Things, on the RN homepage. Now, sally forth.
Very good morning to you. My name's Libby Price. Great to have your company on A Country Breakfast on RN. Australian farmers have long claimed to be the most efficient in the world. Can they continue to reign supreme, though, as the spending on agricultural research declines? Certainly, the older model of state governments running ag extension services has long gone, and not just in Australia.
I think we do have to secure our capacity to carry out research and provide independent advice. I think that is important. I don't know that government-employed and operated extension services are that successful anymore anywhere around the world.
We'll travel the country with our rural reporters, but before that, let's find out what's been making news this week with Edwina Farley. Hello, Edwina.
Morning, Livy.
And after it being so dry, hopefully we're going to get a wetter winter.
Yes, a bit more of an optimistic outlook this week from the Weather Bureau, which is predicting above average rain, although warmer than usual temperatures for most of Australia from June to August. The winter outlook, of course, will be particularly welcome for those in western Queensland and inland New South Wales, which have had really no rain for quite some time now. But for Western Victoria and South Australia, the outlook for rain is not so bright. The Bureau's Dr. Andrew Watkins says warmer conditions are expected in the Indian Ocean off southern Sumatra.
And that's really driving a lot of moisture into the atmosphere that's feeding into these cloud bands that sweep across Australia at this time of year. And so while the odds are just saying above average rainfall, we are seeing a decent setup here in the Indian Ocean for getting above average rainfall.
And while it's been so dry, the cattle are back out in the long paddock.
They certainly are. Stock routes through central west Queensland that haven't been used in a decade now have cattle walking down them. Boss drover Bill Prow is walking a mob of starving Angus steers past Issisford at the moment, looking for grass. He says there are about 7 drovers with cattle in the region because of the drought, and a strategy is now needed to try and share the grass around.
There hadn't been too many stock come down this way the last few years, but there's a bit of traffic on the other route, and there's plenty of good feed down this way, so we're starting to take this route, yeah.
Yeah, and the drought is just getting worse in some areas of western New South Wales as well.
Yes, it's dreadful out near Brewarrina and Bourke. They haven't had good rain in over 12 months, and they're now waiting to find out if they'll be eligible for additional drought support. Of course, they're sort of hearing now, look, you know, the rain is kind of on the up in terms of a seasonal outlook, but of course that's not helping their financial situation, which is not good right now. John Newcomb from the Regional Assistance Advisory Committee says farmers are hoping for subsidies for transporting stock and fodder, and the State Primary Industries Minister has been briefed on that situation this week as well.
What did happen during that meeting is the Rural Financial Councillor from Bourke, who is also on the committee, provided both the Minister and the committee a frank and honest appraisal of what was happening in that particular region. Both Bourke and Bree are definitely hard hit at the moment.
It really is strange weather at the moment, isn't it? It's so dry there and yet it's raining at the rock.
Oh, just unbelievable. Alice Springs is very happy at the moment because they've had very large rainfalls on a lot of cattle stations in what's been the wettest May in 9 years. They've had over 42 millimetres recorded at Yulara in just 24 hours this week. John Staines from Lindervale Station says the 53 millimetres he got was a big relief.
We've got heaps of rain. Looking outside, there's still very low cloud, but just sheets of water lying everywhere. It's absolutely beautiful. It's still hanging around too, still drizzling lightly. So, yeah, we just about need our rubber boots on here.
Now, most of us would never have heard of the environmental water holder, but it does have a very important job.
Yes, it does, and we heard this week a bit of sort of follow-up, I guess, from the federal budget. The National Irrigators Council is worried that having invested millions of dollars in recovering water for the Murray-Darling environment, the federal government isn't actually committing enough funds to see that through. The Commonwealth Environmental Water Holder is basically an office that manages the government's water entitlement. So it should see its budget to manage that water increase as its water holdings grow. So they kind of grow at the same time. But now, as we found out from the federal budget, there's actually a declining staff budget, and irrigators are particularly worried about that. About $5 million of the holders' budget, which employs six local engagement officers who work across various basin regions. Now, Tom Chesson from the Irrigators Council says the $5 million is a good start, but it's only a start.
And they need to be high enough up the food chain that they can answer people's questions, they can make decisions out in the paddock. We think they will, but at the end of the day, it's only six people. Look, Commonwealth Environmental Waterholder, at the end of next year, will have about 63 staff. I'd like to think that 10% of those staff can be located here in Canberra, and the other 90% are out in the paddock where they're irrigating.
Now, speaking of organisations one has never heard of, this is a new one for me, Ghost Nets Australia.
Yes, and it's a very important job that they do. It's an organisation that since 2002 has removed over 12,000 fishing nets from the oceans, saving, of course, thousands of sea creatures. It's unfortunately, though, having to shut down because as of the end of June, it will have lost all sources of government funding. Project coordinator Ricky Gunn says the federal government's decision to pull the funding is upsetting for everyone involved.
It's not going to happen overnight, but it's just going to go backwards again. We're going to actually undo all that work that we did because over time, without focus on this ghost net issue, the rangers will start to put their priorities into other areas of where they do get funded.
Let's go to coal now. Gee, it's a roller coaster ride at the moment.
It sure is, particularly if you are paying rent and living in some of these mining towns. Real estate prices in Queensland's Bowen Basin mining towns has fallen dramatically. Some agents are now even offering rent-free periods to attract tenants. Now, as a sort of indication of how the times have changed, last year in Moranbah, people were paying about $1,800 a week in rent for houses, which are now attracting about $350 a week. The real estate agent John Wood says the turnaround was quite sudden.
Well, we've had a slowdown in the coal industry, of course. People have gone out of the industry, and plus we've had a large supply of houses and rental properties coming onto the market over the last 8 to 12 months.
$1,800 a week, that's just outrageous anywhere. Now to the Oklahoma tornado, and I have to ask you, Edwina, have you seen the tearjerker video of the elderly woman talking about
with
how
the
she
dog?
Lost a dog?
Yes.
and it emerges from the rubble. And I believe quite a few horses were killed, but the cattle seem to have done okay.
They seem to have sort of avoided the worst of the destruction, if you like. Oklahoma is, in fact, the largest stocker and feeder cattle market in the world. And while there have been some reports of livestock deaths, Bob Kropp, who works in beef marketing, says ranchers are lucky to have escaped major damage.
It looked like somebody had taken a mower that was a mile wide and just cleared out 60 square miles. The livestock are out in the pastures, and occasionally one of these tornadoes will go through a pasture or something, but these livestock are pretty resilient, find a place, kind of run away from them. I mean, they'll do a lot of things, but sometimes you lose them.
Cattle are extraordinary. We've seen that with floods and fires. They seem to be the one animal that manages to get away.
And I can't imagine how they, you know, avoid a tornado.
Well, you can see it coming, though.
Yeah, true. Yeah. Run, guys.
Yeah, run for the hills. Whoops, there aren't any. This is more up my alley, though. I've heard of pink diamonds. Now they're finding red diamonds.
Oh, I know. It just the mind boggles, really, doesn't it? Argyle Diamond Mine in Western Australia's Kimberley dug up three extremely rare red diamonds this week. It's found only 9 red diamonds in 30 years, including 3 which are now on sale at its annual Pink Diamonds tender. Now, the sale sort of showcases the top, the 150 of the world's top diamond buyers. Rio Tinto's Robin Ellison expects the jewels to attract a pretty hefty price tag.
Well, the sky's the limit, really, with diamonds such as these. We will take these red diamonds around the world. At the end of the process, come October, the market will determine the price, but certainly north of $1 million a carat is not unusual.
I've got stuck in my head now that. Is it Beyonce that thinks you better put a ring on it, that song.
Don't ask me.
Yes, I don't think it would be a red diamond one by the sounds of the price.
A million a carat. Ouch.
Now, special new almonds are on their way.
Yes, commercial trials are underway to try to get more nutritious and higher yielding varieties of almonds. The University of Adelaide will expand its almond breeding program with more than $2 million in funding from the federal government and Horticulture Australia. Program leader Michelle Worthenson says almond growers currently rely on just a few varieties which require bees for cross-pollination.
At the moment, the almond industry in Australia really rely very heavily on only three cultivars. So the industry realised that they probably needed more cultivars to be choosing from. Plus, I mean, as all agricultural growers would want, you know, they all want sort of higher production so that they can get a better dollar for the input cost.
Now, younger people, younger than us, said Wena.
Come on, we're spring chickens, Liz.
Well, I certainly don't drink cider, but it really is a bit of a boom.
Well, it is, and not just a passing phase either. Of course, the federal government revealed no changes to taxation laws despite calls from spirit producers, so a lot of relief in the cider production business. And Ian Kingham from Woolworths, he's the general manager for beverages, is now predicting our cider consumption to double in the next 5 years, which, of course, is very reassuring for apple growers who might be trying to break into the boutique cider market.
Because we're seeing so many consumers looking for new products and looking to try different ciders, we're starting to find that the propensity for different retailers and hoteliers to take some extra range is opening up. In terms of the hotel industry, it's still quite fragmented, so that requires probably a lot of door knocking.
I'm afraid I'm still a G&T girl.
Oh, it's very nice, the new cider. We're not talking the sort of commercial 80s type drink at
which
all.
Which was the...
Cordial.
I'll have to give it a go. Thanks, Edwina.
Thanks, Libby.
Edwina Farley with this week's Rural News. Rural Reporter is next.
Hi, Waleed Ali here with a quick word to say that from this Tuesday, RN Drive is broadcasting live and direct from Jakarta, Indonesia. 3 days of programs featuring stories and interviews from the capital of one of our nearest neighbours. We'll be talking politics, social issues, arts, culture, the whole lot. We're very excited to be bringing you these special programs. We hope that you'll join us from 6 p.m. this Tuesday across Australia on RN.
You're listening to Country Breakfast on RN. Let's get out and about with our rural reporters. This week, a focus on volunteers, meeting the people who spend days, weeks, even months rebuilding fences and communities through the Blaze Aid organisation. We find out what makes a great working dog and meet Marg Enkelman, a woman with a vivid imagination.
This is my domain. This is where I have all my fun. And there we are.
Wow, normally you expect to see tools and things like that, but we've got fabric. What are we looking at here?
Well, this is my wearable art, which I've made out of rubbish that I've found around the farm. It's all a bit crazy, but it does give me a lot of enjoyment.
Well, from farm junk to wearable art later in the program. First, though, let's head out and meet some of the volunteers helping to rebuild farms and livelihoods across the country.
Blaze Aid's a family. Once you're a Blaze Aid, you never leave the family, you just keep coming back. It's just so much satisfaction for us to be able to help the farmers, and we'll help whoever. And we go away very happy. Just that I live a lot longer so I can do a lot more. It's great. It suits me down to the ground.
Across Australia, volunteers like Bob Cross are doing their bit to get farmers back on their feet. Whether it's cleaning up after cyclones and floods or rebuilding fences after bushfires have swept through, these volunteers are making a big difference. Hello, I'm Kat McGoran. The Blaze Aid organisation has been cleaning up after national disasters for the past 4 years, with camps springing up where needed. Some volunteers come for just a few days, others spend weeks or months in the one place, doing whatever jobs are needed. Many are retirees or grey nomads stopping in to help out on their travels around Australia. Bob Cross is at Nimitabelle at the moment, in the southeast corner of New South Wales. Bushfires swept through the area in late January, burning out thousands of hectares of grazing country. He's helping out on Emma Jefferson's place at the Kybian Valley at the moment. Stephanie Watson caught up with him at the Blaze Aid camp.
Yeah, the opportunity to help people, also to join in with other like-minded people. They're only here for the one reason. And the social drive too. I live on my own, so it's nice to have meet new friends. And after 4 years, I've got friends all over Australia. Yeah. You know, and also Blaze Aid, not only mends fences and physically helps the farmer, it restores their mental attitude also. Really helps greatly. Because otherwise they'd be years doing this work or give up one or the other. Yeah. And you see in lots of cases, you see the transformation of the farmer. The first two or three days you're on his property, he's flat, he's, you know, not feeling all that chirpy. But after he can see what's going on and what the fences are starting to go up, it changes their attitude completely, yeah.
And in this area in particular, you're working across a couple of properties, but what sort of a change have you seen since you've been here?
I've seen Emma's, she's so much happier now. She can see her boundary fences are in and she can start to bring her stock home. And, yeah, that means so much to them. And that's all we need, yeah, to see them happy and then we can move on.
Across the border in Victoria's Gippsland region, Peter Kelly and his mates are rebuilding fences in the Seaton district. Every Wednesday morning at 6 a.m, Peter leaves his home in Cowes for the three-hour drive north, stopping along the way to pick up other volunteers. They spend the day fencing before making the long drive home.
Very difficult to get a big team together, but so long as I've got two or three to come with me, well then I'll keep coming up as long as there's work for us here.
What do you do on that trip to keep yourselves amused?
Talk about the last trip that we were on, talk about trips that we've been to before, talk about anything that comes into our mind, you know, abuse drivers if they abuse us on the road, you know, just conversation in general. So it seems to be quite happy with the way that we are, and that keeps me awake because, you know, drive up and back is a fair bit in the day, yeah.
I guess, no offence to anyone intended, but no one's getting any younger. It's quite a physical job. It's not easy. How's the body holding up?
Oh, I think it's quite good. You know, like we had one fellow that found it was very difficult, but he's, you know, planning to come again. But if we were doing this day after day after day, yes, you would feel it. But because we're coming up, we put all our effort into the one day and we can sort of rest a bit on the, you know, the next few days, it makes it quite easy.
What is it that you really get out of volunteering?
When you sit back at home, you're nice and comfortable and you think that you've done a day's work to help someone worse off than you are. That's what makes you, you know, really want to do, you know, and get out and do this volunteer type work.
Bushfires also swept through parts of Tasmania earlier this year. Blaze Aid set up a camp at Sorel to help landholders in that area get back on their feet. While most of the volunteers have been out in the paddocks helping with the fencing, others stay back at the camp preparing food to feed the volunteer army. Sally Dacus stops by for a chat with a couple of helpers.
Brian Keatley from Primrose Sands.
You've been manning the barbecue ever since this started. How long's that now, Brian?
Well, the first breakfast was Jan 15th, and every morning since then.
So what's the whole experience meant for you, being part of this campaign?
It's just given me a sense of purpose, Sally. It's after the fires went through and Primrose was saved, I looked over the veranda at all the devastation, just thought, you know, what can I do? I need to do something. I can't just not do anything. So I got in touch with a few people and Blaze Aid came up, and so Sue and myself came the first day and got involved, and it went from there.
So it's a psychological as well as a physical recovery for you?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I just think now that, you know, I get my satisfaction for coming out and doing the breakfast every morning, and the people that you meet. And I always bring Enya, the border collie, and she's there to meet and greet all the people, and she loves it. So it's all part and parcel of it. But it's no big deal, you know, but you get you do get that satisfaction, the sense of satisfaction.
So what do you think about cooking eggs and bacon for a while?
Cooking eggs and bacon, I still love that smell. I'm not fed up with that smell of that bacon. I think we've gone through about 5 pigs, I think, since we started, about 3,000 eggs and that sort of thing. But, yeah, it's all been good.
I'm Chris Kemper and I come from Foster in Victoria. We're here to help with Blaze Aid because it's something I've seen other people do and thought it would be a good thing to do.
Has it fulfilled your expectations?
Oh yes, we accomplished a lot yesterday. Seeing a big fence go right up the hill and that, it's very satisfying. Yeah, at the end of the day when everything's aching, it's really good to stand back and say, you know, that's part of what we've done, yes. Yeah.
The final word on Blaze Aid and volunteering goes to Trevor Ward, another of the volunteers working in the Kybion Valley in New South Wales.
If you're thinking about volunteering, do it. It's a really good experience. You'll enjoy it. It won't be easy. Nothing worthwhile is ever easy, but at the end of the day, you'll feel satisfied. A lot of places where you go to, people are crying when you get there and they're smiling when you leave. So that that gives you a big boost. And some people are almost too proud to ask for help. A lot of landholders think I can do it on my own, or it's a sign of weakness to ask for help, but it's not. And you'd be surprised how many people are willing to help.
When you live in a small community, everyone has to pull their weight, especially when it comes to providing emergency services like firefighting. Hello, I'm Tyne McConnon in the Kimberley town of Kununurra in Western Australia's far north. The local Department of Fire and Emergency Services here, otherwise known as DFES, has a permanent staff of just 15. Not nearly enough people power to fight a fire in an emergency. So to fill the void, they enlist the help of volunteers to literally man the pumps. They're on the lookout for some new recruits at the moment, so to find out what's involved, I've joined Graham Sears and the team on a call out to a grass fire on the outskirts of town. Okay, Graham, so I was sitting at work and I've got the call up. So can you tell me the process? I got a call to say there's a fire in town, but how do you let anyone know, or how do you get volunteers involved?
So we receive a group call from our communications centre, and that contacts all the volunteers' mobile phone numbers. And there's also an SMS and a pager that goes out to all the volunteers to call them, to let them know that there's a fire on.
And how many volunteers do you have on the books at the moment?
About 15 in Kununurra.
Is that a high number for a regional area like this?
It's not as high as what we would like it to be. We'd certainly appreciate having more volunteers, that's for sure, but it lightens the workload, but it certainly does put a demand on the volunteers. We get something like 120 odd calls a year that we attend to in the Kununurra town site itself.
Ever have any problems during the week trying to get people up when there is a call?
Sometimes we do have problems getting numbers to respond to incidents, but generally there's not an incident that goes by that we don't respond to.
And we've got two volunteers in the car here with us now.
Hi, I'm Dan Cox, Facilities and Project Manager for the Shire.
Were you at work before this, before you got the call?
Yeah, I was at work, yeah.
So your work's okay with you just leaving when you have to go?
Yeah, the Shire are very supportive of me being a firefighter, and they've actually nominated them for award through FISA as well every year.
And how long have you been a volunteer for?
3.5 years now.
Andrew, I'm the captain of the fire brigade.
How long have you been a volunteer for, Andrew?
About 21 years now.
And how many times do you get called on a week, or can you get called upon?
Varies depending on the time of the year. We get into our dry season, which is our busy time, so we can get a few calls a year, a few calls a week, sometimes 3 or 4 a day.
And I have to ask, it's volunteer work, it's not paid. Why do you keep doing it?
I don't know, just for the love of it, I guess. No, it's not just scrub fires that we do. We do other things as well, car accidents, structural fires. So we do a bit of a variety.
And we're here. You can see a bit of smoke.
This is Randy. Go around and assess where there's any structural threats. So houses, sheds, businesses.
Follow me around.
Yeah. So you want me to go in the bush, yeah? Yeah, just been chasing down the fire front where the long grass is, or the spare grass. Managed to get on top of that now, as you've seen. Now we're just going to go back and mop up some of the still alight or something. See up there, it's set alight again, so we'll have another go at that. Fortunately, we're on the burnt earth, so we can't actually get on fire now. If we're on the other side of that grass, we'd be putting ourselves in a high risk area, especially if we got bogged, got a flat tyre, the engine stopped working for whatever reason, then we put this whole resource at risk, the firefighters in it, and then obviously the bush brigade, and we're limited with the resources we've got up here, so if we get them stuck or they break down, then it's quite a blow to our arsenal.
And you're a firefighter in the UK. How are fires in Australia different to the UK?
Oh, well, we might have the odd field fire there, which would be a cornfield, but nothing where the wind whips it up and there's such a fuel load as a bushfire. And they move very fast here. I mean, they're outrageous and create a lot of smoke. So you've got to be on it all the time. You've got to be really careful. Whereas in the UK, it's fairly easy to get around because there's roads everywhere, there's water sources everywhere, and the corn's only like a metre high. Where this, you can see, it's about 2 to 3 metres high. Some of the type of trees we've got actually have a few high fuel loading because they've got oil in them. So they'll just go off anyway. It's a lot different.
So we've been in and we've put the water on the fire. It looks like it's almost out. It's obviously smoking a lot still, though. What's the process from now on in?
Now we're going to have a group meeting with all the appliances here, find out where the officer charge strategic plan is now, whether he returns the units back to base, whether we need more resources, and that's what we're going to do now.
So, Graham, you're the district officer. We've come back now. We're back at the station. But I believe the work's not over yet. What has to happen?
Once the fire's out, it's not a case of just pack up and go home. We have to come back to the station and refill the water tanks with water and get the appliances ready to be called out again.
That's David Sears, the district officer with the Department of Fire and Emergency Services in the Kimberley, with our reporter Tyne McConnon. Still to come up on Rural Reporter today, turning farm junk into wearable art. And the key to finding and buying the perfect working dog.
Well, they're not a member of a union. They'll never show up for work hungover, and you don't have to pay them overtime. In fact, you don't have to pay them at all once you've made the initial outlay. Hello, I'm Lisa Herbert, and as you can hear, I'm talking about a farmer's right-hand man, the working dog. Melissa Gamble comes from Tamworth in northwest New South Wales and knows a thing or two about breeding kelpies.
We've got to have good confirmation so we don't breed from dogs that have any health issues, any bad legs, bad hips, that kind of thing, because they've got to last a long time and work a long, hard day. They've got to be level-headed and versatile.
How do you know this particular dog looking at me all cutely is a good dog?
When you're buying a pup, it's mostly based on their bloodlines. It's a bit hard to, like, for an 8-week-old pup to know whether they're going to work sheep or not. But you can tell by the style, by the way they move, their attention, their, you know, personality, whether you're going to get on with that dog or not. That's part of it, I suppose. But it is very hard to tell at 8 weeks of age whether they're going to work or not.
Is it a matter of throwing a boy and a girl kelpie in a cage and letting nature take its course?
Definitely not. Certain dogs are suited to certain jobs, so some dogs are more predisposed to wanting to work in the yard and can be quite excitable. Some dogs are really steady and really good for the paddock, you know, especially when you're moving like mobs of ewes and lambs where they've got to move slowly and take their time. So you want to make sure that you know what the dog's about before you go breeding. If you put two yard dogs together, you're probably going to get a really forceful dog that might be a little bit out of control. Alternatively, if you have two sort of soft dogs, if you put them together, or a soft dog and a soft bitch, you might have trouble making them work. So you've got to know your dogs before you breed them.
How seriously do landholders take their dogs?
Some people take them pretty seriously, which we really appreciate. Some people tend to give them a bit of a hard time. You couldn't get 30 men to go out in the paddock and do the same job that one dog can do, bringing in sheep from the paddock, or cattle for that fact. You know, so they work a pretty hard day for you.
What are the disadvantages of breeding dogs?
It's really, for us, it's the price that people are willing to pay for them. To get a fully broken in dog that you can go out and do a full day's work on, will take you up to 18 months to get that dog to that stage. And that involves you know, you've got to feed them and look after them until they're 18 months old, and then on top of that you've got to train them. And some dogs take 15 minutes a day and some dogs take a couple of hours a day. There's a lot of man hours that go into getting a dog going just how people want them to go, and yet they balk when you say $2,000 or $3,000 for that dog. And that's disappointing to us, because there is a lot of work that goes into it, a lot of time and effort that goes into it.
What are your tips for getting the most out of your dog, and do you see any mistakes being made by landholders?
I think the biggest mistake that people make is they rely on the dog's natural instinct to get the job done, and they don't realise that you can actually train a dog to do a specific task. You can teach them to go left and to go right, not just to bring the sheep to you. And we've got a dog here that we can get him to catch fly-blown sheep for us. So he'll cut a fly-blown sheep out of the mob and hold it, like catch it, pull it down the ground and hold it. Dogs know, they can be taught to back and to bark at the right spot, to sit where they need to sit and all that kind of stuff. And I just think, Kelpies will naturally bring sheep to you, but they won't reach their full potential until they're taught and given directions.
We've spoken about some very expensive dogs, $2,000 to $3,000. Is that the average kind of price for a Kelpie?
Yeah, that's more of an average price for a working dog, like for a trained dog, or even higher. Really good dogs that are performed, that have won at trials and things like that, can go right up to $10,000 to $15,000. Sort of your base price for a pup is about, $350, and can go up from there.
Does a pup have to have a bloodline or a bit of paper to make it a good one?
No, it doesn't. But it's a way of proving their worth. Keeping it in perspective, people pay up to $3,000 for an 8-week-old poodle. So, and that's a pet. These dogs work. They work for you. They do a job for you. So we think they're well and truly worth what people pay.
This is my domain. This is where I have all my fun. And there we are.
Wow. Normally you expect to see tools and things like that, but we've got fabric. What are we looking at here?
Well, this is my wearable art, which I've made out of rubbish that I've found around the farm. It's all a bit crazy, but it does give me a lot of enjoyment.
When you look at a fertiliser bag or the inner tube of a tyre, do you ever think, that'd make a nice dress, or maybe a Michael Jackson outfit? No, neither have I. But for Mark Enkelman, even the slime at the bottom of a cattle trough can be turned into a wearable work of art. Hello, I'm Cassie Huff on the Enkelman's property near Mergen in southeast Queensland, where Margaret creates her masterpieces. We're looking at a green top here. Can you tell me a bit about what it's made from?
This is a bit crazy. My husband said to me to clean out the cattle troughs because we were about to wean. And when I came down, there's this in the troughs was this beautiful weed, too good to throw away. So I put it around a fertilizer drum. It smelt like anything when it had dried. Took it up, stuck it onto a fertiliser bag, and actually this is the winning entry out at Charleville for the wearable art competition, which is made out of rubbish from around the farm. You're allowed to paint and sequins and glitter.
That's just one of about 50 odd garments that we have here. What else have we got?
Well, we've got this coat over here. It's our popcorn, which all the husks, which I've stuck onto fertiliser bags. It's got cotton picker spindles on it and very heavy to wear, they tell me. But it's one of my favourites. I've got a Michael Jackson outfit there, which is a tractor tyre tube, which I'm particularly fond of. Actually, I wore that one to Lady Gaga, her concert down in Sydney with my daughter, who insisted that she also wore some farm wearable art, and so she also wore an outfit.
With these garments, though, that you've used the slime almost here and the husk, how do you keep it from falling apart?
Try and do them well when I do them. I do find sometimes with the fertiliser bags that some of them are certainly recyclable. They disintegrate after a while, and that's always a shock. But no, usually when I do something, I try and do it well, and they survive.
And it's not just skirts and tops and capes that we're looking at. You also have created some headpieces as well. What have we got here?
Oh, this is a fantastic outfit or headdress. My model loves this one. Went down to the workshop rubbish bin, and there was all this little bits of steel, and I've actually welded that. No man better have a look at it, though, but it went together really well, and my model loves that one.
Do you have a favourite? Because they're all named, aren't they?
Yes, they've all got names. No, I don't think I have. I must admit, I think I love them all. Probably my Michael Jackson outfit. I do like that outfit. And that's, people say, oh, you must have a big industrial sewing machine. I haven't. That was all done by hand, sewing tractor tire tubes together. It's a fantastic release of your imagination. It's this incredible freedom that I love. And with wearable art, it doesn't matter what size, colour or age you are. All it wants to do is give you laughter and fun. And to me, that's just fantastic.
Do you feel like you've gone back to playing dress-ups like you were as a child?
Yes, funny enough, a lady came up to me after one of our parades and said, you mob have never grown up. You're still playing dress-ups. And she laughed. And she's probably a bit right there. But I like the saying of Picasso's, that it takes a long time to grow young. That, to me, I like that one, because it's taken a long time. I would never have done this when I was 20. And it's just this wonderful freedom that I love.
So we're down at the shed where you're married to a farmer. How does he feel about you coming down here and welding and getting involved in the wearable art using rubbish from the property?
Well, he's very good, actually. I would feel very guilty if I did it during the day. I often do it mostly at night or if it rains. It's sort of funny on a farm, especially after you've just had floods, to be spending time on your hobby. But yes, I love it when he comes home and says, hey, I picked this up. Is it any use? And to me, that's nearly worth, a diamond ring.
I guess I'll never look at a pile of junk the same way again. That's Marg Enkelman showing off some of her wearable art masterpieces to our reporter, Cassie Huff. You're listening to A Country Breakfast. My name's Libby Price. Next, it's been dubbed the White Gold Rush. It's not gold, though. It's infant milk formula, and China can't get enough of it. It's about the only food processing sector in Australia that's booming.
This, then, was the undead home of the king vampire.
The drinking, you know, I often just write about drinking to control my own drinking.
Reading and making up people doing stuff just feels a little bit bourgeois sometimes. I have to kind of justify and rationalise what I do.
A weekend of books, stories and ideas. RN at the 2013 Sydney Writers' Festival begins today from 10 a.m.
Infant milk formula is in such hot demand in China, smugglers have been arrested with tins of the stuff under their arms. Baby formula is the only growth sector for food manufacturing in Australia, with start-up companies already building processing plants. But the lack of a free trade agreement with China is seriously holding back Australia's white gold rush. Serena Locke has this report.
Every year, more than 17 million babies are born in China. There's a growing middle class, and as the mothers return to work, they want the best for their one child that money can buy. Once upon a time, the Chinese upper class used to employ wet nurses. These days, the milk comes from a tin called Australian Yummy, Gold Roo, or Joey's Infant Formula, and can cost up to $70 a tin. It's the latest craze in white powder to be smuggled across leaky borders. It's the only area of food manufacturing that is not on life support in Australia. And here in the central Victorian town of Turturra, 400 people have good employment prospects, turning liquid milk into infant powder.
We'll be entering a quarantine area very soon. All our spray dry facilities, they're quarantined.
Watch and rings have to go in the pocket as well. Why?
I've seen it fall off into something and end up in a can of infant formula.
I've got
blue overshoes on, shower cap, hairnet, wash and sanitise your hands. I'm not going to be the cause of any contaminated infant milk formula.
George Tepes is the manufacturing manager of nutritionals at the Chitura factory.
And now, earplugs. That spells dangerous levels of noise.
Well, basically, the milk concentrate gets pumped on top of the spray drying chamber, gets atomized in small particles and instantly dried.
In vast stainless steel silos, liquid milk is converted to milk powder. By adding vitamins, minerals, blended vegetable oils and extra protein, it becomes bulk infant formula.
Just conditions the powder and removes the extra moisture that's needed.
Hamish Reid is Business Manager of Nutritionals at Tatura.
Our infant formula plants are running pretty much 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, with very, very little downtime. So our challenge is keeping up with demand.
We produce a range of products. We mentioned lactoferrin, cream cheese, milk protein concentrate, skim milk powders, whole milk powders, some whey products, different types of nutritionals. This is a big site.
Tatura was bought by Bega last year. Bega has invested nearly $11 million this financial year in Tatura, expecting nutritional milk formula business to grow faster than all other divisions. The plant contract dries for the milk formula giants like Mead Johnson, but Tatura will take back some of that production. Hamish Reid.
And we've recently announced to the market that we've secured capacity back from Mead Johnson on that dryer that we utilise for manufacturing of their products, and that gives us access to an additional 5,000 tonne of capacity for directly made and marketed Bega products. Our nutritionals business is growing. I would see it growing about 20% per annum. Our other businesses have varying rates of growth. Certainly our more commoditised products, we'd see those as relatively stable.
It's busy at Tatura, where production is already large, but new companies are making inquiries every day, and one has invested. The old Bonlac milk factory in the Gippsland region, southeast Victoria, has been bought by a Chinese-Australian businessman. It's set to open next month.
I'm the person who realises the client's dream. Now, the principals here wanted to build an infant milk formula. I'm the person who designs it, gets the equipment, gets the project financed, get it going, sets it to work.
This is Graham Cole, general manager for the owner Dajiang Li, originally from Xi'an province.
He originated from a poor family, and his mother always made sure he had milk, and he and his brothers are extremely healthy, and he says, it's his chance to do the same.
It's an $80 million investment with a plan to produce roughly $120 million worth of infant milk formula a year within 3 years.
It is quite an aggressive development program. We are the new people on the block. Our ambition is to meet Tatura, then exceed them using the advantage of contemporary technology.
Chinese investment in Australian milk formula factories is a direct result of the lack of trust in homegrown product.
Zhao San Yi Zhe is less than 1 year old. Last June, little Yi was suffering from kidney stones that were caused by drinking tainted milk. The boy had two emergency operations in just 3 days.
Poisons in some milk might not just be from pure melamine, but actually from melamine scrap that has other chemicals in it. It is normally used. Today, a court in mainland China sentenced two men to death for their role in the production and sale of melamine-tainted milk.
In 2008, six babies died and 300,000 were hospitalised with kidney stones. Any threat of contamination in Australian milk formula would damage the image.
We are a clean, green company in all respects. We are canning our own material in our own cans in Australia. There will be no opportunity for the material to be adulterated or broken down in China.
The value of selling to the Chinese pure Australian product is the key to this next business, which has been going 4 years. Based in southeast Melbourne, Milk Powder Solutions blends nutrients with powdered milk into tins marked with kangaroos, joeys, koalas and maps of a grass-covered Australia. Everyone here is fluent in Chinese. But even so, owner of the business, Simon Hansford, says it hasn't been easy complying with stricter and stricter Chinese health regulations.
We're quite unique. We buy from the dairies. We buy from dairies in Australia and New Zealand. And we take all the ingredients and then we mix them up in a blender to our formulation, to the Chinese specifications, and we put it into the tins.
You started this business in 2009. What lessons did you learn? Was it immediate success and you were selling tins of infant milk formula straight away into China?
This business is very, very difficult. It's as I said to just recently, after 4.5 years, we're now open for business. It's taken us that long to establish continuity in supply, continuity in staffing, set up the factory to the requirements we actually need. Also, the regulations have been constantly changing. So China has been educating themselves and becoming stricter in their procedures.
How much extra cost is that?
Per container, it's going to add about $40,000. So it's and they're asking us to test, and everyone else, every container. Once you have a history, I think they'll soften that regulation.
What is your projected growth?
Our projected growth is at least 100% yearly, for the next 3 years.
Last year, Australia earned $20 million from infant milk powder sales to China. It's expected to surpass $24 million this year. But to keep this growth in perspective, Australia is at a large disadvantage compared to New Zealand, which enjoys a free trade agreement. Charlie McAlone.
With New Zealand's exports to China, as a result of that free trade agreement, they're facing at the border tariffs at the moment of around half the amount that Australia faces. And that's on a sliding scale going down to zero over a number of years. Whole milk powder, they're now controlling about 98% of that market. So they're really dominating as a result of that tariff advantage that they do have.
Back at the rural supplies store at Tatura in central Victoria, Dean Lombardozzi says the booming demand for infant milk formula is not flowing through to farmers.
The mood of dairy farmers at the moment, I'd have to definitely say they're keeping their money still close in their pockets. They're not really spending a lot of money. They're holding off, I think, until they sort of see a little bit of light at the end of the tunnel. I think there's rumours of a better milk price going for next year, but at the current time, I mean, we haven't had rain in 6 odd months.
Serena Locke with that report on the booming infant milk trade with China, and you'll be able to read more and see photos on our website, abc.net.au/rural. Australian farmers have long claimed to be the most efficient in the world, but can they continue to reign supreme as the financial screws tighten and research spending declines? Mick Keogh of the Australian Farm Institute has just completed an international tour assessing how our agricultural research compares with three other major farm economies.
We had a look at the system in the US. A lot of people point to the land grant research and extension system in the US as sort of the role goal model. It's under similar sorts of pressure to the systems in Australia. It does integrate the universities and the researchers a lot more closely into the system and into contact with growers, which I think is something that doesn't happen here in Australia. We've had a look in Brazil, which of course has a booming sector in the cropping industries, and it's pretty much driven by private advisors, private research and private advisors, and of course there's a lot of varieties owned by the biotech companies that are driving that. We also had a look at Denmark, which has a completely privatised system, so there's no government funding of extension services. It's all privatised. It's helped a little by the fact that there's obviously substantial EU subsidies available, and that assists producers in paying for the services that they obtain. But it really is a model there where growers, producers pay for their own advice and are selective about who they get to provide it, and that's a different model again.
So whilst farmers here complain about the savage cuts to R&D from governments here, it's a global reality.
Certainly, I think so. I think the biggest change, of course, is that information is now instantly accessible and universally available. You could be a grower here in Australia sourcing information that's provided by the US government or anywhere in the world, and that has dramatically changed the things because, of course, it used to be your local extension officer that was the provider and the conduit of that information.
Now, a lot of Australian farmers would actually say they'd rather pay for advice, that they're more accountable and that they're more professional. Is that what you saw overseas?
Certainly that's the case. When you talk to the leading farmers, they regard it as part and parcel of their business operation that they need technical advice, and that's a cost that they understand that they need to pay for. That's the difference between a more public extension service versus sourcing private advisors.
Now, one thing that stuck in my head from what you've said is a boom in cropping in Brazil. How is that? Is it a catch-up thing? Are they starting from a low base, or are they doing it better than us?
It's a mix of things. Brazil did a lot of work, and here it was a government research agency, did a lot of work on adapting the soybean to tropical areas. So most of the Brazilian cropping area is north of the Tropic of Capricorn, and there was a lot of work by the government in adapting crop varieties to those areas. But once they'd done that, huge amounts of land, all of it in what we would call high rainfall zones with very even temperature and all that sort of agronomic stuff. And they can grow up to three crops a year on the same block of land there. So that's where the real expansion has occurred. And, of course, the demand side of that is China. China's become a major, major importer of soybeans. It services both their human consumption and pork and poultry needs as well.
With it being such a success story, is there something to be learned from that that we could attempt to duplicate here? Obviously, we don't have the same growing systems, but at very least the fact that the government led the research?
Yeah, I think it highlights that at the fundamental level, so at the basic level, when things are getting started, it really often requires governments to get things going. So, for example, you could imagine if we were developing agriculture in northern Australia, it will require some public research to get the right basics in place, get the systems going. Beyond that, when the commercial companies come in, they are fairly fleet of foot in servicing the needs of the industry as it emerges.
If they can see there's money in it.
So they're generating money from it. They're commercially responsive to what the industry needs.
Australian farmers seem to be pretty sceptical about how their money is invested and used for research. They never seem to be entirely happy with farmer organisations. Is there a model where it works, where there's a farmer levy that goes to research that it seems to be satisfactory?
I think it varies around the world, and I think there's a bit of a cultural thing there as well. For example, if you look at Denmark, they pay levies. They also all pay membership fees to their farmer organisation, and that provides the extension service, which they also pay for. And so there's a very strong culture in Denmark of doing things collectively because, of course, they're a very small country on the tip of Europe that exports to the rest of Europe. That's the only way they can be successful. Brazil, I think in some respects it's a bit like Australia. I think the larger scale commercial growers in Brazil are fairly sceptical of the role of government. I think they acknowledge that to get them started, yes, the government had a quite important role, but beyond that, it's been the commercial providers that have been the main drivers.
Yes, it's that fine balance, isn't it? Because if you don't have government funding for research that may not necessarily make a profit in the short term, you don't really know what you're missing out on, so to speak.
That's right, and particularly around sustainable rotations, the issue of resistance to things like bacteriothuringiosis, so the BT crops, you know, the cotton BT is an insect-resistant GM cotton. There's signs emerging all around the world that resistance starting to occur. Now, who's going to pick up the cudgels on that and put some real money into working out systems that avoid that problem getting any bigger?
So as the leading agricultural think tank, what do you think we should be doing here?
I think we do have to secure our capacity to carry out research and provide independent advice. I think that is important. I don't know that government employed and operated extension services are that successful anymore anywhere around the world, and I wonder whether there's not some sort of a model in between whereby we do rely on private service providers, but they do have access to information of an objective nature from an independent, if you like, research sector.
Where do farmer organisations fit in with this?
Well, it's interesting. Overseas, they play a very strong role in facilitating. In fact, in Denmark, the main provider of extension and to some degree research services is in fact the farm organisation. They have a very strong culture there of belonging to that organisation, and it's developed to a position where it has a very strong role in being that objective provider of information. Perhaps there is a role for some Australian organisations there, given the way things are going here.
What about the Cooperative Research Centre model as it stands in Australia? Now, there do seem to be some problems with funding running out. They don't have a guaranteed future. It must make it difficult to make investment decisions if they don't know if they're going to exist in a few more years.
Yes, all the jurisdictions we looked at have that sort of model of one sort or another. They regard it as necessary to provide a bit of longer-term funding, a bit of security, and to bring various different agencies together on a common issue or a common development. Everyone struggles with a balance between how long do we make this funding available so that we give them security to get on and do the research versus at what point you have to pull the pin and say, well, it's not going anywhere, terminate that and get on with something else.
Executive Director of the Australian Farm Institute, Mick Keogh. And that's the Country Breakfast for this week. Details of all our stories, rural news, photos and how to get a podcast of the program are on our website. That's at abc.net.au/rural. Thanks for joining the Rural Team this morning and a big thank you to Carey Dell, our technical producer. On RN, I'm Libby Price. Talk to you soon.
Hi, it's Michael Cathcart here, inviting you to join me online for Books and Arts Daily and another fabulous week of listening. Street artist Robin Rode, cellist Johannes Moser, novelists Claire Massoud, Lauren Bucus and Patrick Ness, and all the action of the Sydney Writers' Festival. So much to enjoy. That's Books and Arts Daily here at the RN website.